Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Autism has surged in our consciousness over the last few years as more children are being diagnosed on the autism spectrum and our collective understanding of these disorders has grown. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, one out of every 68 births in the U.S. winds up being diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. Interestingly, boys are diagnosed at four times the rate of girls. As the name implies, autism occurs on a spectrum, which means that it can present in myriad ways at different ages with different characteristics and severity, so it is tricky to diagnose and treat. My guest today, Jennifer Noonan, is the mother of two children who are on the autism spectrum and a fierce advocate for pushing the science of treatment and obtaining supportive schooling. Her memoir, No Map to This Country, One Family's Journey Through Autism, is a gripping exploration of the challenges she and her family faced, often against somewhat hostile medical and educational systems in her hometown of Austin, Texas. Noonan founded and maintains the website thegfcflady.com, which stands for gluten-free and casein-free. Casein is the protein in dairy products, different than lactose, the milk sugar that many of us stop digesting well as we get older. Noonan put her kids on the GFCF diet when her oldest, Paul, was discovered to have inflammation in his small intestine that was consistent with a true allergy to wheat and dairy proteins. The extreme diet did wonders for his behavior and overall well-being, but dietary therapy is not a panacea for all cases of autism. Indeed, many medical practitioners have little experience treating autism and often make categorical statements suggesting that parents need to simply offer more discipline, which Noonan points out is not only counterproductive, but impossible. Author Jennifer Noonan is my guest today on Studio Tulsa's Medical Monday. Jennifer Noonan, welcome to the program. I want to start with basics. Just how do you define autism?
Well, you know, I mean, they call it a spectrum for a reason. I think, honestly, I saw a really nice article recently that said it's not a spectrum across a line. It's really more of a circle, and you have all of these different arenas in which you can be very high-functioning or very low-functioning. You know, you can have someone who is really good at math and has perfectly normal speech and everything, but then they're incredibly sensory sensitive, where they're very sensitive to bright lights or crowds and bright noises. And if you put them in an overstimulating situation, they devolve very quickly into someone who can't cope. Or you could have someone who doesn't really have any sensory issues, but is completely nonverbal. So there's a lot of different arenas, and for an official diagnosis, they end up sort of saying, well, are you high enough in enough arenas to qualify as impaired? You know, I think for me, it's become more of an internal medical diagnosis because of what we've learned, the fact that I believe, for example, in my children, I use the word remission and not recovery because of the fact that it is still there and they are still on some medications. And if we stop that or if they go off their diet, it comes back. You know, it's not a magical cure. It's something that we've got under control.
You spend much of the first half of the book talking about your son, Paul, who's the older of your two children. What were some of his tendencies or behaviors at the time you were both before you sort of received the official diagnosis and then, I guess, thereafter?
Beforehand, he was just sort of a difficult baby, and then it kind of just got worse and worse. You know, he would play this screaming game, and he was very, very sensory. You know, he didn't ever want to be held. He didn't ever want to be touched. He didn't like being dried off after the bath. He didn't want his nails clipped or his hair cut. And people say things like, oh, yeah, my toddler didn't enjoy that either. I'm like, no, he didn't not enjoy it. He would scream and bite and attack like a cornered animal if you even came near him with scissors or nail clippers. You know, he was fighting for his life in sensory avoidant kind of ways. And he had something called echolalia, which is a symptom of autism where they're able to speak, but instead of coming up with their own sentences and understanding the actual meaning of those words, they just repeat things that they've heard, like a parrot who doesn't actually understand the words that he's saying. And he could recite whole television shows and yet not be able to ask for what he wanted for lunch or anything. So he was kind of a complicated case. He didn't necessarily appear to be autistic unless you sort of knew what to look for. He was kind of an odd combination.
Well, when you mentioned the communication difficulties, in particular, there were two aspects of his health. One, you go into some detail about his throat and his tonsils and adenoids and the ordeal that you went through as his mom to try to get him properly treated because he really wasn't able to articulate that that was going on. But sort of once you made that discovery, you saw a direct correlation with you know, his tonsillar enlargement and inflammation. But also, of course, what became a cornerstone really of his treatment was his GI tract. And he it sounds like had, if it's lunchtime, I apologize to our listeners, but diarrhea and really not formed stool for what amounted to the first several years of his life.
Oh, absolutely. We didn't completely get it under control until he was probably 5 or 6 years old. But as we were, like you said, as we began treating it, we were seeing improvement. So we sort of knew we were on the right track. It was just a very difficult problem to get over. But like you were saying, yeah, he, up until very late in his recovery, where he was communicating and fully mainstreamed in class, and no one would really have said, oh, this child has an impairment, speaking about pain specifically seemed to be something that he really, really struggled with. And so you would take him to the doctor, and they would say, does it hurt? And he'd say no. And it absolutely did hurt, but he just didn't know how to express it, or he felt uncomfortable with it. It was very strange. But when he was very young, you know, when he couldn't answer any question, he would get hyper, or he would start to throw tantrums. And the tantrums were a symptom of pain for him. That was his way of indicating that he was in pain. But people would look at him and say, oh, well, just he's poorly behaved. He needs a good spanking, and then he'll stop screaming. And that really wasn't what was going on.
Well, yeah, to that effect, you talk a lot about how, well, first I want to ask, I guess, about the diagnosis itself, because that is a fraught area, having a child diagnosed on the autism spectrum. It seemed to take some time for you, and then that ties into kind of the difficulty you've had in a number of ways with the medical profession, where you went to a neurologist who you write about in the book in some painful detail, who was incredibly frightened, I think, to give you your son a diagnosis of autism. And when you acknowledged that you at that point thought he had it, you know, he was greatly relieved because he thought he was going to be delivering this bad news, when in fact you wanted to know what to do. You were ready to move into an action phase, and here this neurologist was kind of dancing around the issue.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the neurologist, certainly he had no excuse. He knew what he was seeing, and he just didn't want to say it. You know, we had other doctors. I had 2 days back-to-back where one doctor said, I'm not worried about autism, not at all. And the very next day, a different medical professional, a therapist, said, oh, he definitely has autism. You know, so you get, there's a lot of misinformation. Partly it's physicians who just don't know what to look for, don't understand all of the different ways that autism can manifest. And some of it is just legitimately, they don't want to say it because they believe there is no treatment. So why crush these parents' dreams if they can wait and make somebody else do it? I've also since heard, and this is horribly depressing, but I've spoken to another neurologist who he has said, you know, kind of confidentially because we're friends, he said he's been told by the school district in his area, stop diagnosing this. Every time you give out a diagnosis, we get another kid who's looking for speech therapy, who needs services, who's not prepared for school, and we're just not able to handle any more of these kids. So just don't give a diagnosis. When they're 5, maybe they've improved a little. Maybe they haven't, but we can't keep giving all of these speech therapy services to age 3, which is when special education starts. And so that's also just really depressing to hear a doctor say, yeah, we've been told to stop telling parents there's something wrong with their kid.
That is pretty shocking, actually. Although you relate in the book to the struggle with education and with school administrators who, as I think your experience pointed out and you write very clearly about, really are almost automatically in this adversarial role with you as a parent because of that reason, right? The cost of special education and therapy for, you know, children with special needs, or in this case, autism, can really be, I guess, in the school's point of view or the district's point of view, prohibitive.
Absolutely. And, you know, to a large extent, I don't blame the schools, certainly not the teachers. The teachers all care very deeply about the kids. And most administrators as well, you know, wish that they could help these kids. But then you have legislatures cutting funding left and right. And, you know, they simply don't have the money. And you can't make the money be there if the money's not there. And you can't make a therapist show up if you're not going to pay her. And that really is what it's come down to. And I've had several parents tell me, in this recent round, in Texas where we are, there was a big, big round of cuts where everything just got slashed and there was no money. And the school district basically was telling parents, as part of, no, we're not going to give you anything, I recommend you sue us. Because if enough parents sue the school district, it's no longer the school district's problem, it's the state's problem. And if that gets back up to the state legislature, then maybe they can change it and realize, oh, we've made a horrible mistake, let's give some funding back. But the school's hands were tied, and they basically said the only thing that they're going to understand is legal action. So please, sue us, because we want to help you, and we can't.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Jennifer Noonan. She's the author of the fabulous memoir, No Map to This Country, One Family's Journey Through Autism, about her family's journey through autism, including the medical care and the special educational needs of her children. And she has a website called thegfcflady.com, and I'll explain what that stands for. GFCF means gluten-free, casein-free, which is a special diet that you came up with or learned about. And I guess I wanted to ask you, how did you discover diet as a means of therapy for autism?
Oh, it was absolutely the internet. Not a single doctor told us about it. You know, it was really just me frantically going online and looking, you know, what is autism? What do I do about it? What are the treatments? And you get on enough message boards and you get on enough websites and people say, well, we did therapy, we did this, we saw the neurologist, but then we put him on the GFCF diet, and that changed everything. And you say, well, what is that? So you start Googling what that is, and you come across this mountain of information that is all parent-led, and it's not on any doctor's recommendations, it's not on any WebMD or any of the Mayo Clinic websites, it's all parents. But the parents are not saying, you know, well, this is fun. It certainly isn't. You know, this is something that maybe is kind of helping. Parents are saying, this made a massive difference in my child overnight, and this was a huge change for us. And, you know, you read enough of those stories, and you start to think, well, what have I got to lose? You know, I've got, on the one hand, doctors telling me there's absolutely nothing I can do. I might as well give up. And on the other hand, you have parents who say, I've been where you've been. I tried this, and it changed everything. And that is enough. You know, you say, is it going to hurt him? Well, no. If he stops eating dairy, that's not going to hurt him, so why not try it?
And so it really, one way to look at autism is that it's a gastrointestinal disease, or it's really a complex sort of multi-system inflammatory disorder that we don't fully understand, but it does seem to have this strong gastrointestinal component, but it's not necessarily true for all kids on the autism spectrum.
Yeah, that's certainly true. You know, the doctor that we have worked very closely with, who has helped my children tremendously, he says, anecdotally, it's about 80 to 90% of the children that he performs scopes on. And whether, you know, that remaining 10 to 20% has a completely different type of autism or a different genetic susceptibility, we're not really sure. But even children who don't seem to show outward gastrointestinal distress often find that they have the GI disease internally. And really, it comes down to a chicken and the egg question. You know, was it the fact that they have an immune disorder that causes their GI tract to be malfunctioning, or is it at root a GI disease which is causing a flare in the rest of the immune system in the entire body? And it's not necessarily critical to have an answer to that yet. Obviously, we want an answer, and the medical community needs to study it. But from the perspective of an individual parent, all that matters is, did my child sleep last night? Is he in pain, or is he potty trained? You know, and from a practical standpoint, if you treat the GI disorder, the neurological symptoms get better. So it kind of doesn't really matter which one is causing the other, as long as your child is better and they can speak to you and they're able to function better than they could before.
What's so striking about that part of the story both is, of course, how, as you point out, it's the internet and the stories shared by parents of children with autism, and how I was so impressed by how your process was largely trial and error, but was in that way was truly scientific. I mean, you became an absolutist in a sense regarding the diet and really limiting to down to zero, you know, no milk protein, no wheat protein. And as a person who didn't like to cook, you decided, because of, in a way, your science, you decided, well, if you were going to get something out of it, which was to make this website and to start recording and showing before and after videos, and then also having these recipes. So can you comment on, I mean, your approach to science this way?
Yeah, I mean, I say in the book, I'm a big nerd with a love for statistics, you know, and I've been kind of disheartened by a number of the studies that we've participated in. You know, when you have a child on the spectrum or any, you know, kind of specialized medical disorder, you get invited to participate in these studies, and you don't really realize, you know, when a big institution does a study, where do they get these people? Well, they send out emails. They put them on message boards. They say, hey, do you want to participate? We'll give you $5. And you can participate in dozens and dozens of studies. And we've had studies performed that, you know, we've participated in, And I look at the methodology and say, this is designed very poorly. You know, you're asking question A, but you're not accounting for the possibility that there's a third answer in that is neither of the two answers you gave. And people, I think, maybe aren't really aware that a lot of studies are just what parents are reporting, and they're not based in actual data. And I was just absolutely determined to have data. And I didn't really care if it applied to anybody else, really, was what it boiled down to. I wasn't looking to publish or to say this affects all autistic kids. And I found out with my second child that many of the things that worked for one child did nothing for the second child. And so, you know, that's interesting in a more global sense to say, well, obviously, it's not a universal set of symptoms. Every child sort of needs a specialized treatment. But if it worked for my kid, it worked for my kid. And if I could take down the data and the numbers and say, look, when he had this, he screamed 5 different times in the next hour. And when he didn't have this, he screamed 0 times in the next hour. That's data, and that means something. Even if you don't know why it means something, you still can say there is a correlation here.
Well, I think you bring up a really interesting point about the fact that you have very willingly tried to participate in some of these studies to try to further the knowledge of the field, and you mentioned your disappointment. Are the investigators, the scientists, the physicians, the medical scientists, are they open to this kind of feedback and dialogue, or is it a mostly don't bother me, you're just in the study, and you know we don't have room for your feedback type of experience?
Most of the ones that I've been able to get in touch with have been very open to it. You know, a lot of studies are done by grad students. It's a different tier of studies that are done by, you know, established giant labs that are usually sponsored by somebody, which is why they don't necessarily study the things you want them to study. But the grad students, they're looking to write their thesis, you know, and so they want it to be good. And when you write them back and say, hey, you didn't really account for this, a lot of them say, oh, I didn't know, because they don't have a child with autism. And I think that's one of the things that we've learned, is that the researchers who got into it because they have a child on the spectrum are the ones who have really thought it out. And they know how to ask the questions that are going to get the good data. And as awareness spreads, I think you end up with more researchers and physicians who sort of understand what kind of questions they should be asking. But early on, it's been very touch and go on the design of particular studies.
Jennifer Noonan, why do you think that so many in the medical profession, and you gave a story earlier in the interview where you mentioned a doctor that you saw who said that Paul, your son, did not have autism, definitely did not, and just needed a spanking. I mean, why were so many physicians, and maybe this is somewhat lessening now with more awareness, but why so many dismissive or overly simplistic in their evaluations and recommendations to parents of kids on the spectrum? I mean, why, if this knowledge is available, why isn't it translating? I mean, and I guess you can't really know, but what's your theory anyway, mm-hmm. as to why it's not translating into, say, the medical academy, so to speak?
Well, part of it is just that the number of children has risen so dramatically, and that's really something that people occasionally still try to debate, but it has been settled. The number of children quantitatively is skyrocketing. There are too many children compared to previous generations. There's something going on. And so part of that is just, if you went to medical school 40 years ago, you didn't learn the same things because there weren't the same things to learn about autism. And part of it is also, I think physicians are put into a little bit of a bind because they get nervous parents who come in worrying about every tiny thing, and they spend a good portion of their day legitimately reassuring parents, no, there's nothing wrong, that's a totally common rash, a fever's fine, you know, basic things. But it's harder to recognize some of these symptoms very early on. A poorly behaved child does often look like a child with autism. And you have to sort of know that parent and have that established relationship to say, you know what, I know you. You're a reasonable parent. I see that you're doing everything right, and still your child is doing this. Something else is going on. And I think part of it is also just that we spend 10 to 15 minutes with a doctor now. You know, you don't have that opportunity to establish that relationship with the doctor. And I don't, you know, you can argue about whose fault that is, but I think at the end of the day, it is unfortunate that we don't have that ability to spend more time.
One thing that became clear was with your experiences with your children, you know, in settings, clinical settings, whether with doctors or therapists, the more time that your children had, I mean, the more learning, you know, you could do as a parent and the more evaluation the professional could do. So, right, so a 15-minute visit just isn't going to cut it. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Jennifer Noonan. She's the author of the memoir, No Map to This Country, One Family's Journey Through Autism. And it's her family's story of her two children who are actually now, as you relate, in remission from autism, really due to your incredible vigilance in your science. I mean, it was quite a struggle, which you detail painstakingly. I wonder if you'll share with us the metaphor of no map to this country, and you have a nice prologue where you talk about, you know, you're traveling to Italy, but you wind up in Holland.
Sure. Well, that's actually a well-known essay called Welcome to Holland by a wonderful woman named Emily Pearl Kingsley. And she has done a huge amount for the special needs community, and she works for Sesame Street now. She's amazing. But that essay, if you're in the special needs community, you know it. You almost know it by heart because it gets passed around. It sort of, it helps you as a coping mechanism when you first hear this diagnosis and you don't know what to do. The essay sort of illustrates what it's like to receive a diagnosis where, you know, you want to have a baby. You've planned your whole life for this trip. You're going to go to Italy. You're going to see the Colosseum. You've got everything planned out. And then the plane lands and the flight attendant says, "Welcome to Holland." And your whole experience is, no, I was supposed to be in Italy. And they said, no, you're in Holland, and that's where you're going to be. And it extends this metaphor as to, you know, it's a different place. It's slower. It's not as flashy, and there's not as, you know, scooters running around. But at the same time, there is beauty. And if you spend your whole life wishing you had gotten to Italy, you'll never appreciate all the beautiful things about Holland. It's a very kind of, you know, comforting silver linings kind of metaphor, and that's why they give it to parents who are newly diagnosed. It sort of is meant to help ease the sting. But at the same time, it's not necessarily applicable to autism. There have been several people who became very bitter reading this essay because it's not all tulips and Rembrandts and, you know, just sit back and relax at the life's slower pace that you've been handed. It's kind of a nightmare on a lot of occasions, especially with autism. You know, your child is physically attacking you and biting you and injuring themselves, and now you have a child covered with bruises and you're covered with bruises, and you go out to the store and every person looks at you like your husband is beating the both of you, and you have to tell everyone, no, I didn't do this, my husband didn't do this, he did this to himself. And then, you know, it's a difficult life, and it's not the same as just relaxing in Holland. And there have been counter essays written. Someone wrote an essay called Welcome to Beirut, which was intended to be more of this, no, with autism, it's a war zone, and this is what it's like. So the metaphor of Italy and trying to get to Italy, you know, that really was what we were trying to do. We were kind of flaunting what that essay is supposed to be suggesting and saying, no, I'm not going to accept Holland. I am going to fight for Italy, because I felt like we could get there. I felt like it was not a realistic thing to say, this is all there is and you have to accept it. I felt like I didn't have to accept it because I kind of, that's a little bit just my personality. I've never been willing to just accept somebody else's answer. I'm very defiant when it comes down to it. And so the idea of no map to this country is just this overarching metaphor that I use about the fact that, you know, you don't know where you are. There is no map, and you hope to get to Italy. Maybe you do, but, it, you know, to just sit there and accept your fate, I think, is not a good idea in any situation.
But there were certainly times you felt like you were much more in Beirut than you were in Holland.
Oh, certainly. No, with us, it was never Holland. It was always Beirut. I take that back. My daughter was very easy in some ways. She was too easy. And I talk about the fact that if I had just had her, I really might not have fought so hard. And I really might have given up sooner because, like I said, she did not respond to a lot of the things my son did. And it really kind of seemed like nothing was working for a long time. But because my son was so difficult, he was the type who would just attack and bruise and run into traffic and constantly make my life difficult, I had fought so hard and seen results that I simply could not be convinced that the situation was going to be any different for my daughter. I said, no, there is a connection. I am going to fight for her because I know I can get her out of this. And it wasn't as painful with her, but it was also harder with her. So each one had their own experience, I think.
Right, and they couldn't have been more different, as you relate. I mean, in terms of the physicality and then in terms of the response to therapy. And tell us, your daughter's name is Marie. What was more typical of her behavior or difficulty with, you know, muscle tone and things like that?
Well, she was a much more of a classic case. You know, she was speaking, she was developing normally. My son was weird from the very beginning, but she had a completely normal development up until 12 months, and then she lost everything. And because we had my son, we immediately knew, you know, you don't have a talking child who suddenly goes nonverbal and that's okay. You know, we immediately knew she had regressed into autism. This is what we were dealing with now. And she basically just turned into completely non-responsive. You know, she just wanted to be held and have her head on my shoulder all day long. And she didn't want to talk, and she didn't want to go anywhere. She didn't want to run. She didn't want to walk for till very late. And so she was just sort of the unengaged type, the type that they talk about where you say she won't make eye contact. It's like she doesn't hear her name. It's like she's not even aware of anything. And that was sort of her subtype, which was very different from my son. And she responded to a type of therapy specifically that allowed her to sort of stay removed. You know, social anxiety was a big part of it for her. And so when she was put into a particular therapeutic situation where there were other children and the therapists were doing one-on-one teaching with the other child, and she was able to just sort of watch from a distance and not feel any expectations put on her, she would sort of step out and she would imitate that other child. But the minute you turned your attention on her and said, oh, Marie, do this too, she would drop out again. She just did not want anyone focusing on her at any point. And eventually she sort of was able to come out of that, you know, with a combination of therapy and medication. You know, my biggest fear is that people start to assume that I'm against therapy because I am such a big proponent of certain medical therapies, and that couldn't be further from the truth. You know, it really is a combination of both. But it's like, I've used this metaphor in the book, it's like being in a horrible car accident that shatters your legs. You are going to need physical therapy to walk again, but you also need a doctor to set the bone and give you antibiotics and sew up the gash and make your legs medically ready to heal. And then you need the therapy to make up for the fact that you had this horrible trauma and you have to recover from it. And both of those halves are necessary. You can't make it with just one and not the other from either side.
How did the book project come about? I mean, it sounds like you're someone who is, as you mentioned, very data-oriented, and so you kept notebooks on pretty much everything. Were you also journaling at the time, and how did you decide to turn it into a memoir?
Well, I very first began it when my son responded to going dairy-free within 48 hours. We had a massive, massive speech out of him that we had never had before, and that was the moment where I realized, okay, there is something to this. I'm going to follow this path and not that path. And the fact that I'm following a path that most doctors say is not real, that means I need to prove that it is real. I need evidence. I need to write this down. I need the videos. I need the data. And so I sort of decided that I was going to start writing this book right then, when I had no idea that we would ever get to full remission at all. But I decided that I needed the whole process. I needed it all written down. And part of it was also for me, you know, because a lot of these events that we were going through were very traumatic. It was very stressful. It was very scary. And to write these certain scenes down allowed me to sort of purge them and let go of them. I've always found writing to be a therapeutic activity for me. And so a lot of times I was writing just for me. And I had no idea if I was ever even going to publish it. Possibly it was just going to be for me so that when the kids were older and fully recovered in my, you know, fantasy land, then they could read this and they could sort of know their story. And then when it was done, it really had turned into a real genuine memoir, and I kind of said, well, maybe I can get it published. Why not try? It's finished. I've done it, so I might as well try.
Jennifer Noonan, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Congratulations on the book and, more importantly, on being such a fierce advocate for your children and to the success that you've achieved.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Jennifer Noonan is a parent of two children in remission from autism and author of the memoir, No Map to This Country, One Family's Journey Through Autism. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.